Black History Podcast. I'm your host, Nashad Carrington. Now, we've made a few updates and changes to the format of our show, and really it's because of some scheduling issues that we've run into recently, but I can promise you that the quality won't change, and if anything, it might get a bit better. At least, we hope you'll feel like it improves. Now, this week's episode is from a trying time in the history of the diaspora. A troubled time, really, and in fact, an unfortunate series of events that is for the most part not talked about, and I can venture to guess any number of reasons as to why this story isn't promoted and discussed in or kept in the back of people's minds in the same way as other atrocities and other instances of genocide throughout the global history. But I'll allow you to venture down your own pattern of thought once we are done here today. Now, much of the known information on this subject actually came from the publication of a book called King Leopold's Ghost that was written by an American author named Adam Hochschild. The interesting thing about that book is that before it was published, it was actually refused by 9 of the 10 major publishing houses here in the United States that an outline was sent to. But it actually went on to become an unexpected bestseller and really won the prestigious Mark Linton History Prize for its literary style. The book was awarded the Duff Cooper Prize, and eventually, by 2013, more than 600,000 copies were in print in more than a dozen languages. The book was also the basis for a 2006 documentary of the same name that was narrated by Don Cheadle. Now, the title of the book and the documentary was adopted from a 1914 poem called The Congo, and was written in 1914 by a poet from Illinois named Vachel Lindsay. The poem reads, "Listen to the yell of Leopold's ghost, burning in hell for his hand-maned host. Hear how the demons chuckle and yell, cutting his hands off down in hell." So this might actually be a great spot for us to do two things. One is going to be warn parents, students, and educators that this episode might be a bit much for some of our younger viewers, as well as it's going to be quite graphic in its depictions of violence, amputations, and possibly some of the worst atrocities that you'll ever hear me describe, or at least some of the worst that I hope to ever describe. Now, the second thing that we're going to do is actually take a really quick sponsor break. So sit right there, hear a word from a sponsor, and we'll be back with more.
Are you an emerging artist? Are you concerned about your community's issues? Do you understand your innate ability to engage the masses through art?
Sensitize works to assist artists in reaching their highest potential. Through creating and implementing community projects with emerging artists, Sensitize aims to engage the masses in developing solutions to underserved community issues.
Contact Sensitize for more information.
So just in case you didn't catch on to the topic for today, whether that be because you didn't read the topic for today, or I haven't been explicit enough with the location description, this episode is actually all about three things. First, the horrific history of the Congolese Holocaust. Two, the impact of colonial-minded King Leopold of Belgium. And three, the gross impact that one commodity can have on the lives of those that the rest of the world refuses to acknowledge. Now, I think and I hope that you all will see and learn and gain a better understanding of these things as we go forward in this episode. So to start, let me give just a little bit of history and information regarding the current Democratic Republic of the Congo. Now, I understand that it would take an entire episode or series of this podcast to accurately capture the full history of a country and region as rich and as vast as the Congo, but I'll try to give a brief overview that'll at least bring us up to the speed, to the time frame that we're going to be talking about. All right. So foremost, the Democratic Republic of the Congo is located in the central sub-Saharan part of Africa. It's a country of about 905,000 square miles, so just slightly larger in landmass than the combined areas of Spain, France, Germany, Sweden, and Norway, and a population of about 81 million people. It's surrounded by Angola to the southwest. A small piece of the country touches the Atlantic Ocean. the Central African Republic to the north, the Republic of Congo to the northwest, South Sudan to the northeast, Uganda, Rwanda, Burundi, and Tanzania all to the east, and Zambia to the south and southeast. Now, the area that we currently know as the Democratic Republic of the Congo was first settled about 80,000 years ago when members of the Bantu tribe migrated from the area presently known as Nigeria. Now, between the 14th and early 18th centuries, the Kingdom of the Congo was there. The Democratic Republic of the Congo is the world's largest producer of cobalt and a major producer of copper and diamonds. In fact, being the second largest diamond producing country in the world. But more importantly to our story, there is, or was at some point, a high abundance of rubber present in the region as well. Now, before we dive deeper into the importance of rubber to the world and really to our story at large, it's really necessary to develop the background, founding, and history of colonization of the region. Now, rubber is one of the most important products to come out of the rainforest, but it wasn't actually until around 1839 that rubber found its first practical application in the industrial world. In that year, Charles Goodyear accidentally dropped rubber and sulfur on a hot stovetop, and that caused it to char like leather, but remain plastic and elastic. I'm sure you understand the development that this accident spurred along. Now, the invention of the automobile in the late 19th century resulted in a crazy rubber boom. And unfortunately for the indigenous populations of a number of towns and villages across the globe, this meant that these otherwise sleepy places very, very quickly turned into the breeding ground for colonial exploitation and became ultimately bustling centers of commerce. The Congo region was no different, except the exploitation took on a much harsher tone in the colonization and exploitation of this area. Now, in 1876, King Leopold II of Belgium founded the International Africa Society, which was supposed to extend humanitarian projects, but invariably the society was nothing more than a front for Leopold to dupe the Belgian people into believing that his interest in Africa was purely altruistic. Now, in 1878, Leopold invited a man named Henry Morton Stanley to join him in exploring, researching, and as they would put it, quote, civilizing the continent, end quote. Also in 1878, the International Congo Society was formed. It was formed with much more direct economic aims, but was still very closely related to the Africa Society. Leopold would actually go about secretly buying off the foreign investors in the Congo Society, and it very quickly turned its sights to a more directly imperialistic goal. Between 1878 and 1885, Henry Morton Stanley returned to the present-day Congo region as a special envoy on the behalf of Leopold on what would amount to a secret mission to develop and establish what would eventually become the Congo Free State. Now, I'm sure that there are many of you who either know or have heard of that part of the history, but there's a lesser aspect of this story that truly goes to develop what would become. Now, Morton Stanley was an intelligent man, make no mistake, and he actually took the lessons of Manhattan Island in New York Bay and the fleecing that the Dutch put on Native American tribes buying the 22 square mile island from the Native Americans for just $24 worth of trinkets. Morton Stanley took the same approach to the Congo and actually had indigenous chiefs mark X's on legal documents written in foreign languages that they had never even seen before, while Morton Stanley called them treaties. For example, on April 1st, 1884, Morton Stanley executed the following treaty with the chiefs of the Ngombe and Mafella tribes. Quote, "In return for one piece of cloth per month to each of the undersigned chiefs, besides present of clothes in hand, they promise to freely of their own accord for themselves and their heirs and successors forever, give up to the said association the sovereignty in all sovereign land and governing rights to all their territories, and to assist by labor or otherwise any works, improvements, or expeditions which the said association shall cause at any time to be carried out in any part of these territories, all roads and waterways running through this country, the right of collecting tolls on the same, and all game, fishing, mining, and forest rights are to be the absolute property of the said association. Now, I'll throw my legal hat for half a second here. That's a very wide blanket statement. And again, being in a language that these people have never seen before, never heard before, is a very nefarious way to conduct business. But it wasn't business, and I'm sure you can realize it was exploitation. Now, not long after Morton Stanley returns to the region, the French actually found out about these plans and very, very quickly decided to dispatch their own exploratory and colonization committee that was led by a naval officer by the name of Pierre de Brazza. He was actually dispatched to the same area in Central Africa, but he went into the Western Congo Basin. De Brazza would go on to raise the French flag over a newly colonized country called Brazzaville in 1881, but we know it currently today as the Republic of Congo. Now, right here, I'd like to make sure that we don't get a little confused, or I don't assist you in getting confused. If you're a fan of geography or know all the countries in Africa or are just highly astute, then I'm sure you'd realize that we've now made reference to more than one place called Congo. So foremost, there is a country called the Democratic Republic of the Congo that for a time was known as Zaire. There is also a country called the Republic of Congo. It was called Brazzaville that we just discussed a moment ago. Now the two countries actually share a border as we discussed before. So hopefully we don't confuse the two. In general, throughout the rest of this episode, we'll be referring to the Democratic Republic of the Congo. All right, just that for reference, the Democratic Republic of the Congo that was at one point known as Zaire. So anyhow, the Portuguese had already had a colonial empire in the region, but largely had abandoned it in the years prior, deciding to revisit and recolonize the area and actually stake their claim as well, resting its claims on decades-old treaties with Spain and the Roman Catholic Church. The Portuguese would very quickly enter into a treaty with the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Ireland to ally and block off the Congo society's access to the Atlantic Ocean. Clearly, this was a move of strategy, but to recap, we now have major Portuguese, the French. Like, these are major colonial players all vying for the same region, space, materials, and resources. Now, these places are the Portuguese, the French, the Belgians, the British, and even the Catholic Church. And as we previously mentioned, I'm sure you'll assume, the interest of these European countries was not philanthropic or democratic, or even for the purpose of sovereignty promotion, but was instead for exploitative and selfish reasons. By the early 1800s, these countries and Western powers in general were realizing the abundance of valuable resources that Africa contained, including gold, timber, land, markets, and as we discussed, especially related to this episode in the Congo region in particular, rubber. Due to the European race for African colonies, Germany started to launch African expeditions of its own. And of course, with the economic power and influence that Germany had during the time, this scared the mess out of the British and the French. Hoping to soothe and smooth out the potential bubbling conflict, Leopold convinced France and Germany that the collusion of common trade in Africa was in the best interests of all involved. Now, obviously, these interests weren't in consideration of the African continent. From the support of the British and at the initiative of Portugal, then German Chancellor Otto von Bismarck called on representatives from Austria-Hungary, Belgium, Denmark, France, the United Kingdom, Italy, the Netherlands, Portugal, Spain, the Sweden-Norway Union, the Ottoman Empire, and the United States to participate in the Berlin Conference to work out a joint policy regarding the African continent. Now, between 1884 and 1885, the Berlin Conference, also now known as the Congo Conference or the West Africa Conference, took place. And its primary purpose was to determine the regulation of European colonization and trade in Africa during the new imperialism period. It also directly coincided with the emergence of Germany as an imperial power. And this wasn't a conference held by mistake, as I'm sure you'll soon see in just a moment. The conference also ushered in a period of heightened colonial activity by the European powers, which ultimately would result in the elimination or eroding of most then existing forms of African autonomy and self-governance. Now, if we jump back to that treaty that I referenced before, I'm sure you can understand why this African autonomy was dissipated. Out of the Berlin Conference came the General Act, which fixed the following points of contention between the countries. First, in order to assuage the general public and further gain acceptance, there was a resolution to end slavery by African and Islamic powers, with what amounted to a general international prohibition of the slave trade. Now that sounds well and good, but remember who was told that they had to end slavery? African and Islamic powers. We're not touching any other countries. Second, the 14 signing powers would have free trade throughout the Congo Basin. Third, the Niger and Congo rivers were made open, free, and available for ship traffic, obviously in an effort to allow the competing powers to export whatever goods, resources, and materials they extracted and import the materials, supplies, people, etc. that was needed to effectuate the extractions. Fourth, and probably one of the most important, especially to our story today, was a general principle of effectivity was established and introduced to stop the colonial powers from setting up colonies in name only. Now, I'm going to stop here for just a second and really address what this, quote, effective occupation meant. The principle of effective occupation meant that the powers could acquire their rights over the colonial lands only if they possessed them or had effective occupation over the land. Now, I know that sounds repetitive, but bear with me momentarily, and I'll break it down even further. So basically, if treaties with local leaders were in place, if the colonial power flew its flag in the colony, and if they established an administration in the colony to govern it with a police force to keep order, they could have the land. All right. So what's worse about this principle is that the colonial power was permitted to make use of the colony economically as they saw fit. The principle of effectivity became important not only as a basis for European powers to acquire territorial sovereignty in Africa, but also for determining the limits of their respective overseas possessions, as this effective occupation would serve in numerous instances as the criteria by which disputes over boundaries in the colonies would be settled. Now, there's a whole lot more we could discuss about this principle and its constructive effects, but the biggest thing that I want you to understand about it, as is especially needed in reference to the Congo, was just laid out. So we'll go back to our list of conference takeaways. Now, fifth, it was determined that any new act of taking of possession of any portion of the African coast would have to be notified by the European power taking the possession or assuming a protectorate to the other 14 powers signing the act. Sixth, there were hard set definitions for the region that each of the European colonial powers were provided, along with the exclusive rights to legal ownership of the land. Now, I know that doesn't really make a whole lot of sense, but let me see if we can. Essentially, the borders of the countries were set right here at the Berlin Conference. Before, you got to remember, this is kind of like open land. You know, there are indigenous tribes in various regions. There were no countries. There were no borders. The Berlin Conference is where these countries' borders came from. Now, finally, and the most important to the meat of our discussion today, the Congo Free State was confirmed as the private property of the Congo Society, which, as we mentioned, was established to support Leopold's promises to keep the region open to all European investment. By the act confirming this ownership of the Congo Free State to the Congo Society, about 2 million square kilometers, or about 1.2 million miles of land in the Congo region, became the personal property of Leopold. How, you may ask? Well, the Congo Society had one shareholder and one chairman. Remember back, we said Leopold went about actually buying out foreign investors of the Congo Society? Well, this is why. I'm guessing you can probably deduce who that person was, who was the one shareholder and the one chairman. If your guess was Leopold, then you'd be correct. Ding, ding, ding. But I'm sorry, there's no prize for that response. Further, this move was institutional in nature. Not just because Leopold was then king of Belgium, but also because the Belgian government had in fact lent money for the startup investment and exploratory efforts of the Congo Society. So in effect, the Belgian government had in fact lent money directly to Leopold to own the Congo region as his own private investment. Now, Leopold fervently believed that the overseas colonies were the key to a country's greatness, especially in the economic and geopolitical arenas, and he worked tirelessly to acquire colonial territory for Belgium. The acquisition of the Congo region brought in a workhouse of economic empowerment for Belgium and an area of land more than 60 times the size of Belgium. Now, bear in mind, before the conference was held, European countries, for the most part, treated African indigenous people in a similar manner to Native Americans, to mean for the most part they formed trading relationships with local chieftains, but by the mid-19th century, Europeans began to consider Africa to be disputed territory ripe for exploration, trade, and settlement by their own colonists. But the colonization of the Congo Free State by Leopold ushered in a new wave and type of colonial relationship that, as far as we know, had never been seen before. Now, I know I mentioned earlier that this story was going to be graphic, and if the history of the colonization of the region is enough and you are of a weaker stomach, I'd encourage you to proceed from this point with caution. Not only are we going to address the brutal nature of occupation that Leopold and the Belgian forces he employed rained upon the indigenous people, but we'll also present some direct writing and observations from Europeans who were on the ground. But before we get to the brutal nature of Belgian occupation, let's grab a word from our newest sponsor here at the Black History Podcast, and we'll be back with more.
The Notorious VAG. Finally, a publication for women by women. Do you have questions about your health and you're too embarrassed to phone a friend? Do you wish your doctor would make house calls? Or are you just curious for more knowledge about your own body? TheNotoriousVAG.com is here to answer all of those questions and more. Written by Dr. T, a respected female obstetrician and gynecologist, The Notorious VAG will entertain you with tales straight from the exam room, while informing you and dispelling the countless myths that exist about our female nether regions. So, if you're ready to be empowered with knowledge about your own health, visit thenotoriousvag.com today. And be sure to subscribe to get our semi-weekly posts. Again, that's thenotoriousvag.com, and follow us on Twitter at notoriousvagdrt, a publication for women, by women, empowering women.
Welcome back. Now, before we dive into the brutal nature of the Belgian and Leopold, allow me to first state that this brutality was not something new or novel for European countries to have inflicted on indigenous people of the African continent. You know what, for that matter, let's make it the African continent, South American continent, the North American continent, anywhere else. Like, this wasn't new. The biggest difference, in my opinion, are twofold. So first, the then Congo Free State was owned solely by one man and solely under his control. And then two, the time frame of brutality and immense death and destruction inflicted on the region and the people was severely condensed, making the impact much more profound, as the time was limited by decades from other instances and compacted to primarily the years between 1885 and 1908, really a span of only 23 years. So here's the thing. Very, very briefly, I'd like to give you some background information to the evil tyrant that was Leopold. This isn't to give proverbial life to this man, but to just provide full insight into the backdrop that cultivated vile evil. Leopold was the second king of the Belgians, and actually born in Brussels as the second but oldest surviving son of the first king, Leopold I, and Louise of Orleans. He would succeed his father to the throne on December 17, 1865, and would reign for 44 years, which would actually be the longest reign of any Belgian monarch. However, as a young man, he was described by his cousin, Queen Victoria, as a, quote, unfit, idle, and unpromising heir apparent as ever was known, end quote. And then by the first Earl of Beaconsfield, Benjamin Disraeli, as physically having, quote, such a nose as a young prince has in a fairy tale, who has been banned by a malignant fairy, end quote. Now, I'm going to take that to mean that obviously Queen Victoria didn't think he should have been heir. He was unfit to be heir to the throne, and the Earl of Beaconsfield thought he was ugly. That's how I'm gonna take it. Now, when he was king, he didn't even bother to deny the charges levied against him in a London court that he had had sex on multiple occasions with child prostitutes. Yes, you heard that, child prostitutes. Rumors circulated that he had a mistress, as was told to him by the Bishop of Ostend, to which he replied, quote, people tell me the same thing about you, Your Grace, but of course I choose not to believe them, end quote. A very pompous and arrogant man, but that for the most part is enough about Leopold. But there's one more comment from him that I'll mention, but I'll save it for later, and you'll see why when the time comes. So just kind of flow with the story a little bit, all right? So we talked before about how the Belgian Conference saw the heads of 14 European countries, and the United States mixed in there too, come to the table to discuss the future and fate of Africa. And most of these countries had already had a presence in the region prior to the conference. The French had forced labor systems for decades prior to the arrival of Leopold, and those were in the French colonies west and north of the Congo River. The Portuguese ruled Angola. The Germans ruled Cameroon, and they both had similar systems in place as well. Though these areas had much less rubber yield, the brutality was much of the same. Systems in place where hostages, slave chains, starving porters, burned villages, paramilitary sentries, and the Chakotay were commonplace. So right here, I have to take a second and explain the Chakotay to you. The word Chakotay comes from the Portuguese word for whip, and the Chakotay was a terribly vicious tool that was made of raw, sun-dried hippopotamus hide that was in fact cut into long, sharp-edged corkscrew strips. In the Congo Free State, the Chakotay had another name as well. It was the fimbo, and when used, it was applied to the bare skin, namely the buttocks, and left in its wake a vicious set of permanent scars on the recipient. And it's told that 20 strokes of the Chakotay would leave the victim unconscious, and in most cases, 100 or more strokes was deadly. If you are interested to see what the Chakotay or fimbo, F-I-M-B-O, looks like, you can surely conduct a simple Google search to find it. Chakotay is spelled C-H-I-C-O-T-T-E or C-H-I-C-O-T-E, Chakotay. Either spelling will get you results, but be warned, there are also numerous pictures of individuals being beaten with the Chakotay, so don't say that I didn't give you a fair warning prior to. Now, we mentioned that part of the Berlin Conference resolution required the colonial power to maintain what amounted to a police force to retain order in the colony, and the Congo Free State was no different in having one to comply. Leopold organized the Force Publique, which is a French word for public force, in 1885, corresponding with his start of private rule of the region. Now, the officer corps of the Force Publique was entirely European, a mix of Belgian regular soldiers and mercenaries from other countries who were drawn by the prospect of wealth or simply attracted to the adventure of, quote, service in Africa. But serving in the rank and file membership under the European officers was an ethnically mixed African indigenous soldiery, with many being recruited from local warrior tribes, while others were conscripted from other Western Africa areas and Zanzibar. But under Leopold, the Force Publique had a primary purpose, and it was to enforce the strict and harsh rubber quotas and ensure the continuation of the other forms of forced labor. We previously touched on the burgeoning importance of rubber during this time, and the Force Publique was essentially vital to ensuring that the colony made money as a private Leopold enterprise. So how did the Force Publique enforce these quotas and ensure that the status quo went undisturbed? The soldiers were armed with modern weapons, including rifles and handguns, as well as the chakotay. But most importantly was the reign of terror that the soldiers imparted on the indigenous people. Numerous reports from foreign missionaries and consular officials detail an astounding number of instances where indigenous Congolese men and women were raped or flogged by soldiers of the Force Publique, where the Force Publique was unsupervised and, worse yet, unrestrained by the European officers charged with their command. Now, right here, I want to really state for the record that while the soldiers of the Force Publique were in fact African and protected interests adverse to their own in most instances, the structure of the force was surely wrought with institutional issues and problems, and primarily during the early years of the force, there were numerous instances of mutinies by the African soldiers. In effect, many of these African soldiers who took to mutiny refused to inflict further pain and suffering on their own in the interest of protecting European interests. Because of this, by the mid-1890s, only about 10 years after its inception, much of the eastern portion of the Congo Free State was actually under the control of Arab ivory and slave traders. But trust me, this doesn't end our discussion, not by a long shot. Moving ahead, as we mentioned, one of the primary goals of the Force Publique was to enforce the strict rubber quotas on those in forced labor. But how did they enforce this? Really, it was through terrors of violence. That's how. Failure of the labor force to meet its quota was punishable by death. The Force Publique were required to provide a hand of their victims as proof when they had shot and killed somebody, and it was believed that they would otherwise use the munitions they were provided for hunting food rather than enforcing the in-place laws. As a consequence of these enforcement efforts, the failure to meet quotas was often paid off in a chopped-off hand. I warned you that this episode would get brutal. The sadistic nature of this practice resulted in soldiers of the Force Publique oftentimes collecting hands for sport. But worse yet, in other instances, there are reports that small wars were started when villages would attack another neighboring village to gather hands, since the rubber quotas were unrealistic to fill. The baskets of severed hands set down at the feet of the European post commanders became the symbol of the Congo Free State. The collection of hands became an end in itself. Force Publique soldiers brought them to the stations in place of rubber. They even went out to harvest them instead of rubber. In effect, severed hands became a sort of currency. They came to be used to make up for shortfalls in rubber quotas, to replace the people who were demanded for the forced labor gangs, and the Force Publique soldiers were paid their bonuses on the basis of how many hands they had collected. A European junior officer of the Force Publique described the experiencing of punishing a village that protested harvesting rubber. He went on to state, quote, "The officer in charge ordered us to cut off the heads of the men and to hang them on the village palisades, then to hang the women and children in the palisades in the form of a cross," end quote. Now, a Danish missionary recounted his experience seeing a Congolese person killed for the first time, but most importantly, the response and direction he had received from a soldier who witnessed his reaction to the sight. And he would say, quote, "Don't take this to heart so much. They kill us if we don't bring the rubber. The commissioner has promised us if we have plenty of hands, he will shorten our service," end quote. But the atrocities being suffered by the indigenous people wasn't lost to Leopold. In fact, it's recorded that he wrote to his Secretary of State to say, quote, "These horrors must end, or I will retire from the Congo. I will not be splattered with blood and mud. It is essential that any abuses cease," end quote. Now, while that line may appear that Leopold was concerned with the blood that was resting on his hands, actually no pun intended, he is also reported to have some point directed the following in response to the allegations of brutality in the Congo Free State to say, quote, "Cut off the hands? That's idiotic. I'd cut off all the rest of them, but not the hands. That's the one thing I need in the Congo," end quote. So I'll ask this question, which Leopold do you believe? Now, I can't help but think that he knew of the brutalization, encouraged it, and purposefully turned a blind eye to what was taking place. I think we see that just from those two quotes. His official stance is that he doesn't know, but privately and less formally, he says he needs the hands, but doesn't seem to care about the rest of the body. Now, that callousness tells me that the mind of a madman was at work in the region. Of course, Leopold took a formal stance to reflect that he knew nothing of the brutalization, because all the while on the international scale, while he siphoned away the riches received to build his own palaces all over the globe, he assured other countries that he was bringing Christianity to the indigenous populations. But it wasn't just the rank and file members of the Force Publique that were responsible for its gross crimes. It was definitely the officers as well. The Congo Free State amounted to, if nothing else, a virtual and literal playing ground for the sadist mind and deplored actions. There was one officer named René de Permentier, who went about having all of the trees and bushes around his house cut down so he could shoot at passersby. He had women prisoners sweep a courtyard and then would conduct an inspection. And if he found a single leaf, would have a dozen of them beheaded. If forest paths were not well maintained, he would order a child killed in the nearest village. There was another officer named Leon Rom. Rom was born in Belgium, and after being poorly educated, joined the Belgian army at the age of 16. And 9 years later, at the age of 25 in 1886, he found himself in the Congo searching for adventure. Well, unfortunately for the people of the Congo, he became district commissioner and was put in charge of African troops of the Force Publique. Now, according to reports, Rom's brutality knew no bounds. Rom had a reputation for killing masses of people for the most petty of reasons, and then keeping the persons as trophies. Rom had a notorious flower bed that was rigged with human heads, and he kept a gallows permanently erected in front of the station he managed. Now, I think you can understand the reign of terror that was imparted on the indigenous people. I don't believe that terror is more effective than forcing someone to work under the threat of having hands and feet cut off, or worse yet, those of their children's being cut off, women being raped, men being executed, and whole villages being burned in the pursuit of profits. Here's where the barbarisms add up. As we discussed prior, much of the knowledge on these events was brought to the light by Adams Hochschild. Well, Hochschild ventures to capture the exact levels of death that resulted during this time. And between 1885 and 1908, it's undoubted that millions of Congolese died as a consequence of exploitation and disease. It is estimated that sleeping sickness and smallpox killed nearly half of the population in the areas surrounding the Lower Congo. But without doubt, maintaining and determining the actual numbers of people who died is impossible to account for. However, Hochschild actually makes a compelling argument for rough but accurate accounting. In fact, saying that the early official estimates were pretty correct in being used to determine how many deaths occurred. Now, I know that usually we'll challenge any state-sponsored official reports, especially when it comes to accounting for indigenous deaths at the hands of Western and European powers. But bear with me, and let's see if you agree with his assessment. Hochschild says that roughly half the population perished during the Congo Free State period. And while this is an amorphous calculation, let's follow that train of logic. Now, the Belgian government conducted a census after it acquired the Congo Free State from Leopold, which we'll actually address a bit in greater detail in just a moment, and found that there were then 10 million inhabitants of the country. So that's to state, if half the population died during Leopold's reign, that would say 10 million indigenous persons died. But of course, it is virtually impossible to know for sure. And I'll take it upon myself to assume that that number is still conservative in nature, even being at 10 million. So we just touched on it, and eventually Belgium would take control of the Congo Free State from Leopold and the Congo Society. After almost 25 years of death, maiming, and other deplorable acts, what caused this shift in control? So there's a few factors that actually led to this shift. European and US press agencies began to pick up on the stories and the destruction that was caused, but much of that came from missionaries in the region who exposed the atrocities through reports and, most poignantly, pictures of men, women, and children with limbs cut off, primarily the hands, and in some instances, both hands. At that point, around 1900, the press could no longer ignore what was going on, but worse and possibly more nefarious was an effort to expand their own colonial empires in the region by expelling the Belgians. Most of the pressure actually came from the United Kingdom. But here's the crazy thing. Hochschild says that Leopold and the Congo killings weren't the worst in colonial Africa. Hochschild says if you reckon the mass murder by the percentage of the population killed, the Germans did just as much in present-day Namibia, if not worse, and that might be its own episode for another day. Plenty of information on that, so we may get to that. But after the media began raising questions and issues related to the humanitarian abuses and violations of human rights law, the Belgian parliament decided it was time to force Leopold to relinquish control of the colony to the civil administration in 1908. The country of Belgium would control the Congo colony until its independence in 1959. In the interim, the number of murders diminished, but mutilations and exploitation continued. But the tragedy that was the Congolese colony wouldn't magically be completed with the Declaration of Independence in 1959 when the Belgians left the country. It was in such a state that millions more died in a series of wars and because of basic government incompetence to rule. I'm sure we'll have a future episode on this for sure. Actually, I know we will. It's a very important person in history. But the murder of future president Patrice Lumumba set the country back even further, and then the approximate 100,000 deaths was followed by the disastrous government of Mobutu Sese Seko. The First Congo War between 1996 and 1998 was quickly followed by the Second Congo War that was between 1998 and 2003. That would be the deadliest war in modern African history, with approximately 5.4 million people being killed, mostly from disease and starvation, making it by far the deadliest conflict worldwide since World War II, but mostly unknown and unreported by the West. Just like Leopold's Holocaust was largely ignored and virtually unreported as well. Now, the true lasting legacy of Leopold and the Belgians has been the resulting chaos ever since, and a disastrous ruling of dictators like Mobutu, which left a lasting impression of corruption that led to Mobutu stripping the country of even more resources than Leopold. Between 1896 and 1906, only a 10-year span, Leopold stripped the country of about £3 million, while Mobutu embezzled and stole about £3 billion. When the Belgians left the country, there were only 3 Africans in managerial positions and fewer than 30 college graduates in the entire country of 10 million. Hochschild profiles several people in his book who were responsible actually for making the world aware of the genocidal realities of the Congolese Holocaust, including George Washington Williams, an African-American politician and historian who was the first to report the atrocities in the Congo to the outside world in his publication titled, quote, "An Open Letter to His Serene Majesty Leopold II, King of the Belgians and Sovereign of the Independent State of Congo, by Colonel the Honorable George Washington Williams of the United States of America," in 1890. Hochschild goes on to profile William Henry Shepherd, another African-American and a Presbyterian missionary who furnished direct testimony of the atrocities. Also, E.D. Morrell, who was a British journalist and shipping agent, who was actually responsible for checking the commercial documents of the Congo Free State, who eventually realized that the vast quantities of rubber and ivory coming out of the Congo was matched only by the number of rifles and chains that were coming in. From that information, he realized that very quickly the Congo Free State was anything but free, and instead was a slave state. And then he devoted the rest of his life to fixing that issue. So speaking of the records that Morrell noticed, I'm sure the question arises in your mind as to where are the records? Well, Hochschild addresses that fact too. He profiles an individual named Jules Marchal, a former Belgian colonial civil servant and diplomat who spent 20 years trying to break the Belgian silence about the genocide, but found very, very quickly that the documentation was not easy to come by, as the furnaces of the palace in Brussels is said to have spent more than a week burning incriminating papers before Leopold turned over his private Congo to the Belgian nation. For many, many years, the Belgian authorities prevented access to what remained of the archives, notably the accounts given by the Congolese to the King's Commission. So that was a lot. It was a whole lot, I know, but thank you for bearing with us throughout. But I hope that we're able to shed some light on the issue and educate you to a lot of the things that have been hidden. In closing, I hope that you truly enjoyed this episode, learned something intriguing, and are ready for our next ventures. Please be sure to check us out for new and updated topics. In the event you have any questions or general commentary about this episode or any other episode that we've done, I'm sure you hear it in my voice that this has been long and arduous. If you have any questions or general commentary about this episode, send us your feedback to info@thisiscarrington.com. That's Carrington with 2 R's. Or visit us online at www.blackhistorypodcast.com. Suggest new topics for us, events or people we should cover, or if, as always, you just wish to drop us a line and give us your thoughts or perspectives to an episode we've done, we will try to make every best effort to include listener mail or commentary to future episodes. And as always, I say, as we take this journey together, we will do our best to present the diaspora in the most objective light, with some occasional commentary presented. But if you come across any errors or mistakes, please let us know, because as we like to say here, only steal.